that did not happen in JP Morgan's case. And this is not just like one isolated incident. This was happening over and over again over a period of many years, where people inside the bank repeatedly rang the alarm bells and then were just overridden by people higher up the food chain.
Compare what happened to Jeffrey Epstein to Wesley Snipes.
Yeah, so, and Wesley Snipes, the actor, was another JP Morgan client in 2006. And he was accused of tax fraud by the federal government. And almost instantaneously, he had not been convicted of those charges. He had not admitted to those charges. Almost instantly, the bank kicked him out as a client. And this was almost exactly the same time that Epstein was initially indicted and arrested on for alleged sex crimes. And which is arguably more serious than a tax fraud allegation. And instead of swiftly kicking Epstein out of the bank the way they had done with Wesley Snipes, they had a fairly robust internal discussion that culminated in the bank deciding to keep him as a client with basically no strings attached.
We're talking to David Enrich, Deputy Investigations Editor for The New York Times. The major new expose he co-authored headlined How J.P. Morgan Enabled the Crimes of Jeffrey Epstein. A Times investigation found America's leading bank spent years supporting and profiting from the notorious sex offender, ignoring red flags, suspicious activity, and concerned executives, which takes us to the higher ups. If you can tell us about Jess Staley, once the leading contender to succeed Jamie Dimon as chief executive of J.P. Morgan, how he had an ongoing relationship with Jeffrey Epstein at the bank, outside the bank, would later become head of Barclays in Britain. Just take us through that relationship and then his relationship and what he discussed with Jamie Dimon.
Yeah, and so the relationship between Jess Staley and Jeffrey Epstein was long and multifaceted and quite intimate, I think. And Staley was basically a lifetime J.P. Morgan employee until 2013. And he was the person who, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, developed a very close relationship with Epstein, who at the time was this kind of up-and-coming client at the bank. And the relationship started off, I think, just purely in financial terms. Staley was trying to get to know Epstein because he was an important client of the bank and could make important introductions to other potential clients for the bank. But over the years, it evolved into something much more than a traditional client relationship, I would say. Staley became, I think, a close friend of Epstein. When Epstein was incarcerated in Florida in 2008 and 2009, Staley went to visit him. Staley also visited a number of Epstein's properties, including when Epstein was not even there. And on at least one occasion, we know that Staley ended up having sex with a young woman whom he had met at Epstein's townhouse and who later alleged that Epstein had basically sex trafficked her. And all the while, inside J.P. Morgan, when these concerns would arise about whether Jeffrey Epstein is involved in crimes and whether the bank is involved in facilitating or enabling those crimes, over and over, we see Jess Staley, in some cases joined with other executives, but always Jess Staley going to bat for Epstein, trying to kind of damp down these internal concerns and to insist that this is someone the bank needed to continue doing business with. And he went to bat for Epstein over and over again. And it ranged from kind of interacting with low-level compliance officers to really senior people within the bank, like the general counsel of the bank, who had grave concerns about Epstein and was persuaded ultimately to not really take a stand and insist that he be fired from the bank. And I mean, I think one of the ongoing mysteries here is where J.P. Morgan's CEO, Jamie Dimon, was in all of this. And Dimon he's been CEO for a long time. He is someone who likes to boast about his attention to detail. He is known as a bit of a micromanager who is really like on his subordinates, trying to know everything that's going on. And in this case, Dimon claims that he knew nothing about Epstein. He didn't even realize Epstein was a client, he says, until after Epstein was arrested and jailed in 2019. And You know, that is, first of all, a little bit hard to square with Diamond's repeated insistences that he knows everything that's going on inside the bank, but also with the fact that Jess Staley, under oath, has said that he talked to Diamond on a number of occasions about Epstein's status as a client. And we also reviewed internal emails from the bank that appear to show with other employees of the bank mentioning the fact that Jamie Dimon is going to be involved in some of the decision making around whether to keep Epstein as a client. And I don't know what the truth is here, but it seems like there's kind of a binary choice. Either Jamie Dimon knew about Jeffrey Epstein as a client and has been lying about that under oath and in other forums, or Jamie Dimon didn't know Jeffrey Epstein was a client and somehow was out of the loop on this really important client and on an issue that was really sowing great divisions among some of his top lieutenants at the bank. And, you know, we talked to David Boies, the lawyer who has sued J.P. Morgan, among others, for its role in the Epstein saga. And he described both of those options. He said that neither of those options is good from Diamond's standpoint. And, you know, I'm inclined to agree with that analysis.
And what happened to Staley went on to head Barclays, and what happened there in Britain?
Yeah, so he, after leaving J.P. Morgan, he became the CEO of Barclays, and he lasted in that role for several years until Jeffrey Epstein was arrested and charged and then committed suicide in jail. And a lot of questions began to emerge about what Staley had done for Epstein, both at J.P. Morgan and at Barclays. And an investigation later determined that Staley had been really dishonest with Barclays about the nature and duration of his relationship with Epstein. And so he was fired by the bank and later banned by British regulators from having a senior role in the UK financial services industry. So, and I think his career is pretty well done at this point. But, you know, aside from losing his job, my understanding is that he walked away with a huge fortune that he derived in part over the years, because he was proving such an effective advocate and such an effective manager of the Epstein relationship at J.P. Morgan.
The fallout of J.P. Morgan, you write in the New York Times, has been limited. In 2023, it paid $290 million to settle a lawsuit brought by roughly 200 of Epstein's victims, and an additional $75 million to resolve related litigation brought by the U.S. Virgin Islands, where many of Epstein's crimes took place, right? He owned two islands in the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Yeah, that's right. And that sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money in normal terms, until you realize how much money J.P. Morgan earns. And in 2023, the year that they paid this roughly $300 million in settlement, they made profits of $50 billion with a B. So, and the payments they made in to settle these lawsuits amounted to less than 1% of their profits that year. And so I think one of the things that my colleagues and I have heard over and over as we've been reporting this story is that punishments like this they are unlikely to have a major deterrent effect. And what is really to stop a scandal like this from happening in the future? And I don't know what the answer to that is, but certainly having to pay less than 1% of your annual profits as a penalty does not seem likely to have a huge impact on the behavior of bankers or corporate executives in the future.
And let me ask you this latest news headline, and you may not be able to respond. The request by the Justice Department to a federal judge to reject NBC News' request to unseal the names of two Epstein associates who both received wire payments of what? Something like $100,000 and $200,000 from Epstein back in 2018. As part of his non-prosecution plea deal with federal prosecutors in Florida, Epstein helped ensure that his associates would not be prosecuted. Have you reported on this, or can you comment?
Yeah, I mean, I've done some reporting on it. And again, there are a lot of unanswered questions here. We do not know the associates to whom Epstein was paying these six-figure sums in 2018. We do know, and he had left J.P. Morgan at that point and had become a customer of Deutsche Bank by then. So this is not as far as I know, it's not a J.P. Morgan issue. And I have no idea who those associates were. I mean, they could be his lawyers. It could be the guy who the beneficiaries of his will. It could be women who he sex trafficked. All I know looking at this is that it is remarkable to me that the Trump administration, after rising to power in part based on its assurances that it would do everything in its power to provide transparency about the Epstein investigations, is again doing the exact opposite of that and fighting to keep stuff secret. And again, I don't know, maybe there is a good explanation for why in these particular cases they are trying to keep the secret, but certainly it appears to be part of a pattern in which Trump and his allies are doing everything in their power to keep this stuff hidden from public view.
David Enrich, want to thank you for being with us, Deputy Investigations Editor for The New York Times. We'll link to your piece, How J.P. Morgan Enabled the Crimes of Jeffrey Epstein. Coming up, ICE has launched a major operation in Chicago days after Trump posted a message declaring Shapocalypse Now, a reference to the Vietnam War film Apocalypse Now. We'll speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Viet Thanh Nguyen. Stay with us. Vietnamese musician Mike Hoi performing at Joe's Pub in 2020. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Just days after President Trump threatened to wage war on Chicago, ICE has launched a major operation to target the city's undocumented population. ICE has dubbed the effort Operation Midway Blitz. Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin said Chicago is being targeted in part because it's a sanctuary city. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker criticized the ICE sweep, saying, quote, instead of taking steps to work with us on public safety, the Trump administration's focused on scaring Illinoisans. On Saturday, President Trump wrote in social media, Chicago about to find out why it's called the Department of War. That's a reference to his order to change the name of the Department of Defense Friday. Trump accompanied the message with an AI-generated image depicting himself as Lieutenant Colonel Bill Kilgore from the epic Vietnam War film Apocalypse Now. Trump's pictured in front of the Chicago skyline with helicopters, flames, and the phrase Shapocalypse Now. He also wrote, I love the smell of deportations in the morning, a reference to one of the most infamous lines in the film, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. After facing widespread criticism, Trump then walked back the war threat. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court's allowed the Trump administration to resume indiscriminate immigration raids in the Los Angeles area. In her dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote, quote, we should not have to live in a country where the government can seize anyone who looks Latino, speaks Spanish, and appears to work a low-wage job. We go now to Pasadena, California, where we're joined by Viet Thanh Nguyen, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and scholar, his most recent book, To Save and to Destroy, Writing as an Other. He's professor at the University of Southern California, which is in Los Angeles. We welcome you back to Democracy Now! Viet, let's begin with this Supreme Court ruling that the ICE raids can continue in Los Angeles. Your response.
Well, thanks for having me again, Amy. Of course, it's outrageous. It's a ridiculous enactment of racial profiling, which seems enormously hypocritical in an age when the Supreme Court ruled that race cannot be considered for university admissions, but clearly here says that race and other signifiers of supposed foreignness can be considered for ICE to just pull over anyone who they consider to be brown and potentially a foreigner.
And talk more about what this has meant for Los Angeles, the level of racial profiling. We heard just now what Justice Sonia Sotomayor said, the ability to stop people simply because they're brown, the number of people who have been detained in raids from the Home Depot parking lots and beyond.
And Donald Trump is targeting Los Angeles and California because this is a city and a state in which multiculturalism and ethnic diversity have worked. California has the fourth largest economy in the world. We've incorporated large numbers of people from all over the place doing different kinds of jobs. And we've demonstrated that the American experiment in multicultural democracy and capitalism can actually function. Donald Trump doesn't like to see this kind of thing. He wants to see a white supremacist, white nationalist version of capitalism, hence his targeting of successful democratically led and oftentimes black-led cities. And so the targeting is really obviously a terrible thing. We, you know, many of us in California know people who are Latino, who are brown, who are immigrants, who are documented, who are undocumented, and so on. They are productive, helpful members of our society. And by terrorizing them, Donald Trump seeks not only to cow them and to drive them out of this country, but he also seeks to terrorize and to cow those who are friends and allies of these people as well.
We're talking to Viet Thanh Nguyen, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of several books, including most recently, To Save and to Destroy, Writing as Another, professor of English at the University of Southern California. I wanted to talk to you about the social media post of President Trump. We just talked about it, where he wrote, Chicago about to find out why it's called the Department of War, of course, referencing his order to change the name of the Department of Defense last Friday. Trump accompanied the message with this AI-generated image depicting himself as Lieutenant Colonel Bill Kilgore from the epic Vietnam War film Apocalypse Now. Trump pictured in front of a Chicago-style, Chicago skyline with helicopters, flames, and the phrase Apocalypse Now. Also writing, I love the smell of deportations in the morning. A reference to this, one of the most famous lines in the film.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Viet Thanh Nguyen, when we saw this weekend, we thought who best could talk about the significance of this film, especially, I mean, you're a college professor, you know, many young people have never even heard about it, a film from the 1970s. But this is a film you've often written about and spoken about that defined you as a child of Vietnam. Can you talk about the significance of this post? Every dimension of it.
This is such an absurd post, but it's also an incredible post because it compacts so much of American history into a couple of lines. And so what's basically happening here is that Donald Trump is referring to an entire history that extends to the very origins of American society, origins that are rooted in policies of ethnic cleansing and genocide. We're seeing that continuation of ethnic cleansing, of course, here in Los Angeles and elsewhere in the United States, but we've had a long history of deportations and ethnic cleansings that have been directed at indigenous peoples, at Mexicans, at brown people, and so on. And the connection with the Vietnam War is that by the time the United States got to fighting the war in Vietnam, it had this entire history of genocide built into its consciousness, its culture, its politics, its military, so that when American soldiers went into Vietnam, the mythologies that they brought with them were basically the mythologies of the Western and of Indian wars and so on, which is why American soldiers referred to the land in Vietnam as Indian country. So in that moment, when Colonel Kilgore is saying he loves the smell of napalm in the morning, it's obviously directed at Viet Cong guerrillas, but the smell of burning bodies is evoking the entire history of American troops going into native villages, burning them down, and massacring people, cleansing the land in order for American conquest. This is the kind of history that Donald Trump wants to evoke, wants to celebrate by using rhetoric like I love deportations, but also turning the Department of Defense into the Department of War, one of the more honest things that he's done. And so by evoking Apocalypse Now, he is evoking a long string of ideology, but also of pop cultural references that he thinks celebrates American masculinity and macho militarism. The irony, of course, is that this is a war, the Vietnam War, that the United States lost, in fact. But I think Donald Trump can get away with it because he understands something very basic about the development of American military power over the last few decades, which is the United States doesn't really have to win wars. We just go in and kill a lot of people. And even if we lose that war officially, we still maintain American dominance and hegemony. And I think that's what he's trying to do right now.
I want to go to another clip from the film Apocalypse Now, where you hear Marlon Brando's voice. He's playing Colonel Kurtz.
We train young men to drop fire on people, but their commanders won't allow them to write on their airplane because it's obscene.
What he's saying, we train young men to drop fire on people, but their commanders won't allow them to write the F word on their airplanes because it's obscene. For those who don't know this story, if you can talk about the significance of this, and then it's a bigger point that you make as a Vietnamese American, is who is centered and who isn't, even though this is considered a great anti-war film by Francis Ford Coppola. As a Vietnamese refugee, you talk about what's missing as well.
I mean, the movie is a satire of American militarism. It's definitely a critique of American war power and so on. And it's a very powerful movie in that regard. That satire completely is missed by Donald Trump in embracing the figure of Kilgore, who is meant to be a satirized figure. But one of the things that happens in Apocalypse Now is that Francis Ford Coppola is drawing from this history of colonial genocide. Apocalypse Now is based on Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, which is a devastating condemnation of what the Belgians did in the Congo in the late 19th and early 20th century, killing millions of black Congolese in their efforts to extract resources from that country. However, in both Conrad's novel and in Apocalypse Now, the drama is centered on white men. And what gets erased in the case of The Heart of Darkness is the subjectivity of the Congolese people. And what happens in Apocalypse Now is that Vietnamese people are erased and silenced as well. So on the one hand, in these narratives of liberalism in Joseph Conrad and Francis Ford Coppola, we see a condemnation of racism and war, but also something that's carried out at the expense of the so-called natives and savages themselves. And so that part of liberal narratives of anti-racism, which silences people of color and people from different countries, is something that Donald Trump has intuitively grasped. So that's one of the reasons why I think he's able to use Apocalypse Now to stage a narrative about deportation, because in Apocalypse Now, the Vietnamese people have basically been deported from their own narrative.
I wanted to go to the trip you're about to embark on, Viet. You're coming to Boston, then you're coming here to New York on September 21st. You will be at New York's Town Hall, along with another Pulitzer Prize winner, the Palestinian writer Mossab Abu Toha, also Asif Mandeev, and others. It's an event called Voices for Gaza. And so if you can put together all of this, what's happening in Los Angeles, President Trump declaring war on Chicago, these historic. I mean, the largest raids on immigrants this country has ever seen, and how you relate that to what's happening right now in Gaza.
My understanding of American history is that it has been a narrative of white nationalism and white supremacy, which has been dependent upon creating and dehumanizing and demonizing various others throughout American history. That power of othering is still with us today. I've certainly experienced it as a Vietnamese refugee who experienced the full brunt of American military power and who came to the United States and saw some of the racism that's been directed at Asians, Latinos, Black Americans, indigenous peoples, and more. And so when October 7th happened, what I saw was not simply the tragedy that took place on that day, but an entire history of genocidal warfare and colonization that Israel had already been engaged in Palestine. And I identified strongly with the plight of Palestinians, because one of the first things that one of the Israeli ministers said after October 7th was that they were fighting human animals, by which he meant Palestinians. And that idea of reducing other people to being less than human is one of the key narrative acts that justifies genocide. So I stood up as strongly as I possibly could and spoke out in support of Palestinians and warned as strongly as I could that this war that Israel would embark in would be a war of genocide. So it's been my honor and my privilege to try to lend my full support to Palestinians, especially to Palestinian writers like Mousab Abu Toha. And so on September 21st, there'll be an event devoted primarily to Palestinian voices and writers, but with a few of us who have been allies to the Palestinian cause as well. We'll be there at Town Hall in New York City, and all ticket sales will go to help Palestinian children and orphans in Gaza.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, I remember interviewing you right after the 92nd Street Y. You were invited, and then it was canceled. Explain more about that.
Well, that happened in late October of 2023. And as I said, when October 7th happened, I reacted very viscerally to those events. And I signed a letter soon after October 7th, along with 750 other writers and artists from around the world, warning about the possibilities of genocide taking place and calling for a ceasefire. That letter was actually very controversial, and I probably made it more controversial by posting about it on Instagram and bringing up this issue of human animals, and also affirming my support for boycott, divestment, sanctions. I think it was that constellation of things that got me disinvited from the 92nd Street Y, which is a self-proclaimed Jewish cultural institution. Now, nearly 2 years later, I think the signers of that letter have been validated. It has, in fact, been a war of genocide. It's been impossible now, 2 years later, with so many experts weighing in, to deny that a genocide is actually taking place. And so the calls for ceasefire are, it's still important, and so is this demand of recognition of genocide as well. And so again, two years later, we should listen to Palestinians, we should listen to writers, we should listen to artists, we should listen to scholars who've been dealing with these issues of othering and colonialism and genocide when they tell us what is actually taking place.
The comparison you see between, well, going back to Vietnam, and as we speak now, Israel dropping pamphlets and bombs on the largest city in Gaza, on Gaza City.
The parallels are very striking. The United States, when it went into Vietnam, on the one hand, it was fighting to support an ally, but it was also fighting an enemy at the same time. And basically what the United States did, as the journalist Nick Turse documented, was to kill everything that moves. Every dead Vietnamese was counted as a Viet Cong. And that is a genocidal policy that was certainly carried out throughout American history in fighting the Indian Wars. And it's the same policy that Israel is carrying out in Gaza as well. Indiscriminate killing of Palestinians. Any dead Palestinian is considered to be a potential enemy. This kind of mindset, where there is no distinction between enemy and civilian, is genocidal. It's certainly a policy of ethnic cleansing. It's hard to deny that what Israel is doing is very deliberately policy at this moment of trying to get rid of the Palestinians in Gaza. And so I see a distinct structural parallel and similarity between what Israel is doing in Gaza City at the moment and with Trump's rhetoric of deportation. If Trump had his way, he would literally try to deport every non-white person that he can, and he's getting off to a pretty strong start.
We have to leave it there. Viet Thanh Nguyen, Pulitzer Prize winning author and scholar. We will see you in New York at Voices of Gaza. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman.
Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns, to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcasts.